This is the AdNonTech Podcast, conversations about education, technology, and culture, with Dr. Doug Reed and Dr. Matt Stranick. Thank you for joining us. Folks, my name is Matt Stranick, and I am part of the AdNonTech conversation series as part of the podcasting endeavor. I am deeply, deeply stoked to have with me Dr. Rob Power from Cape Breton University, where he is an assistant professor of education. And full disclosure, Rob and I share some history. We do go back a ways, across decades now, which baffles me to think about it. But if you go all the way back to our time at a little institution in the Middle East, at one point referred to as the College of North Atlantic Qatar, it's subsequently been renamed, rebranded, and there's all sorts of things that are different going on there. But I was really grateful when Rob generously agreed to take some time out of his schedule to speak to us just kind of about what he's up to, and where he's gotten to where he is now in terms of being an educator, practitioner, researcher, and many other things. So much appreciation and respect for being here, Rob. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matt. Thank you for that introduction. Yeah, it's been a while since we've met face-to-face. I think it's been almost a decade since I've returned to Canada from Doha. And had a bit of an interesting journey since I've come back from there. You know, I started out in 2015 over on the west coast of Canada, working for the Fraser Health Authority with their online learning team. Awesome. Really miss the winters over that way, much better than the Atlantic Canadian winters.
No kidding.
So that was a fun experience, and I got to be involved with a major, major project over there. At first, that I got myself in over my head a bit, working with five of BC's seven health authorities to sort of coordinate amalgamating all of their learning management systems, all of their course content, all of their course registrations and records into a single learning hub initiative. And that took up about 2.5 years of my life working on that project with the Fraser Health team. And we wound up being one of the, I think, in the top 10% of Moodle installations in the world by the time we were done.
Number of individual users or clients within the LMS?
Yeah, in terms of the total number of users and the total number of course completions and courses and stuff, we had like a 250,000 registered users on the system. And by the time we launched and sucked over all of the records from all of the various systems into the one, we had on day one over 7 million course completion records in there. So it was a massive, massive endeavor, but it was fun and got my teeth wet on the administrative side of things and on the project management side of things. Yeah. So that was fun. I spent some time at BCIT over there on the West Coast for the better part of a year working with their instructional design team before shifting over here back to the East Coast of Canada, where I'm originally from, with Cape Breton University. I'd been teaching some adjunct courses with Cape Breton University, as well as with Athabasca, Mount Royal, Ontario Tech, a few with the University of Manitoba, before I got into this tenure track position here at Cape Breton University.
Awesome.
And been here since. Thank you. Yeah, I'm actually up for tenure this fall. So I actually have it minimized on my screen here right now. I'm working on my tenure track portfolio as we speak. It's a
Awesome.
growing document. So been here since January 2nd, 2020, I started, which those of us in the education sector know is a foreboding date because just over 2 months from that date, we got sent home for the pandemic and for online learning. So again, I had a massive undertaking and my work cut out for me right from the start of Cape Breton University.
You and there's so much in the literature and practice commentary now speaking to the so-called shift to emergency remote teaching or the pandemic pivot. That's probably my less preferred
Yep.
in jargon for it, but I've been keeping up with Rob's sort of endeavors, particularly since the CBU role began on LinkedIn, which seems to be sort of filling a void of sorts for what academic Twitter used to be about. And really, there are so many sort of places and tangents that I'd like to go when I'm speaking with Rob, simply because his areas of interest and mine overlap significantly, even if the actual practice is different. But in terms of sort of the general kind of unpacking educational practice for people who might be from different areas and different disciplinary positions. I got to ask Rob, East Coast of Canada, first of all, that is Newfoundland and Labrador for you, is your original home base?
Originally, that's my home base, yes.
Awesome. That's great. And in terms of like education within the wider family, like, for some people, they're the first people in their family to even do post-secondary or even, necessarily possibly complete grade 12, right? Or whatnot. I wonder, was education sort of, formal education, as it were, a large part of what your environment was growing up? And like, what was it like for you when you sort of realized that teaching or education was going to be your way forward, your way of engaging with the world, professionally and otherwise, sir?
That's a bit of an interesting deep dive there too. No, I actually come from a long line of educators in my family. I've got a number of aunts who have been teachers, second cousin of mine, my father's cousin was a professor with the education faculty at Memorial University.
Oh.
I believe that my grandmother and her sister also taught for a bit way back in the day. So long line of educators in the family, but that's not where I really started out with it.
Okay.
No, I started out in journalism, working
Do
for
tell.
VOCM Radio back in Newfoundland when I first graduated from university, and it was fun. And I credit a
Bet.
lot of my creative skills and my media savvy in that to my several years of experience working at VOCM. But I was never a full-timer there during my tenure with the radio station. It was always part-time. And the opportunity came up for me in early 2000 to join a BED program at Memorial
Awesome.
University and to do my BED. So I
Very
did
cool.
that. I did that. It was a 1 year post-baccalaureate program. You had to have your 4 year degree before you could go into it. And started teaching English and social studies.
Awesome. That's what the cool kids do. That's what I that's my area as well. That those are my like
Well,
two
don't get too
old subjects.
excited. I only spent a year at that because, on my first week of teaching in my first full-time position was a bit of an ominous date as well.
Okay.
We started off first day I got to work, a lot of our students weren't there because we had a big school bus driver strike out in the Lewisporte-Gander School District in Newfoundland.
Oh.
And then on Thursday, September the 11th was 9/11.
Oh,
So being very close to Gander, Newfoundland, out in Gambo, at the time I had an apartment rented and I was teaching in Herbay, Newfoundland. And with the school bus drivers helping out with the plane people, And then all of the families and their older kids helping out to house the plain people and to feed them and take care of them. We had a big disruption right in my first couple of weeks of teaching.
That is so major, and in terms of embarking forward on the wider career, that's the universe kind of just giving you something there, I think. That's interesting.
It was, and it gave me my passion for what I do with educational technology because, that was back in the day we were using Netscape Composer to make our own web pages, and so I built my own web page in one afternoon up at the school and put it up online, and I just started posting little newsletters for my students and their families and bits of notes and worksheets and stuff if they wanted to keep up
Awesome.
on stuff. And that sort of sparked my passion for educational technology and for distributed learning. And it was a 1 year position I had out there. So I went back right after that and did the joint program, master's program with Memorial University and what was at the time University College of Cape Breton, now Cape Breton University,
Okay.
their master's of education in educational technology. And I switched over to teaching technology education for a couple of years in Newfoundland before I got the opportunity to go over to Doha, where I was over there for a decade. And for
Yes.
8 years, 8 years I was with the School of Information Technology teaching IT courses. And
Okay.
then I spent the final 2 years with the Advanced Learning Technology Center as an instructional developer. And
Now, that is so sick. And again, I just sort of feel for the benefit of, the hypothetical listener, because I'm always surprised, actually, Rob. I mean, you and I and the hundreds of faculty complement and staff and families who cycled in and out of that institution, CNAQ, Newfoundland and Labrador's provincial community college system, was actually selected through a fairly competitive process by the state of Qatar, this tiny, Gulf Arab state sticking out of the side of Saudi Arabia, the kingdom, sort of like a little spur. At one point, it was meant to be part of the United Arab Emirates when they were departing from direct oversight by Great Britain. They chose to go their own way, and as such, it dovetailed nicely with the discovery of the probably richest set of offshore gas resources and attendant oil and petroleum subsidiaries, hydrocarbon-based economy. That sort of developed in a very short period of time at a very massive scale. And so, hence bringing in the vocational college from Newfoundland and Labrador to deliver pretty similar 1 and 2 year training programs with essentially Canadian curriculum with some adaptations and changes, to suit the local context. It was a 20-year agreement, I believe, and Rob spent a decade there. I spent 6.5 years because, for just various factors, everybody has their own amount of Doha time that is correct, and everybody's amount of Doha time is different. That's just a given. Certainly for me, it was a life-changing experience professionally and personally to be there. I can say that I would not have had the opportunity to go as far into graduate study within the field of learning as I would have if I were just sort of, kind of grinding away at, K-12 or substitute teacher or precarious kind of university instructor kind of role. It would have taken much longer, would have been way more difficult. Again, not to kind of horn in on the interview component of it here, but I'm just surprised, Rob, when I talk to people and I'm like, that place in the Middle East where thousands of Canadians lived over 20 years? Like, nah, never heard of it. Okay, I'm surprised, but okay. You and I know about this. So I guess when you're talking about your time, particularly in the Alt Center, Rob, because I always knew you as like a collegial sort of colleague. I was in the language studies and academics department teaching communications. You just sort of become aware of the people who kind of have your similar interests, right, in terms of curriculum, learning technology. And our doctoral study, I believe, even overlapped at a certain point. You completed your doctoral, your EdD, while you were in Doha, correct? I sort of finished, started mine in Doha, and then left for Ontario, finished in Ontario. So I guess I wonder, what was it like? How formative was the Alt Center and CNAQ experience for you? If you're just talking about, you know, setting you up for what you're doing now.
Extremely formative. You know, first of all, likewise with you, if it wasn't for the opportunity to go over to Qatar, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to even do my doctorate. You know, it afforded me the opportunity to do further studies that meshed with what I was doing for my work, but also to be able to afford to pay for that. You know, there's a hefty price tag with high-level graduate studies. So I was able to do that, but I was also able to do my research and have it dovetail nicely with the work that I was doing at CNAQ and with other collaborators. I got involved while I was doing my doctorate with an organization called the International Association for Mobile Learning.
Awesome.
In 2011, I think I first got involved with them. I got the opportunity to do some research with our TPP students from Qatar Petroleum using QR codes as part of a blended learning experience. I got to present on that at IM Learn's annual conference in Helsinki, Finland. And the following year, I ended up being the organizer and the chair for MLearn 2013, the 12th World Conference on Mobile and Contextual Learning, which we hosted at CNAQ in Doha. And because of my work working on that conference, I got elected to the board of directors of IMLearn. And I stayed with the board of directors up until I finished my two-year tenure as president in 2019. And it allowed me the opportunity to connect with some colleagues who I still work with on research endeavors from all over the world.
Awesome. And again, just to contextualize here, Rob, I always knew was seriously, you know, engaged in the learning design educational technology endeavor. Our terminology for our field is just completely nonsensical, but the space that you were doing and what you were involved in, like, I remember very clearly as M learning, you know, as sort of being what you were working on. I was working on massive open courses, you know, at the time as a phenomena such as one did circa 2012-ish thereabouts. And Rob, much to his credit, was very supportive of me in terms of, like, you know, potentially giving me access to some of his research setting, you know, in terms of courses and being able to observe and stuff like this. You know, we had a conversation about it. It didn't end up happening. I ended up sort of carrying out my work other ways. But when you talk about going to a conference in Finland, right, like, I remember I was sent to talk about, you know, Web 2.0 practices in my teaching over in, you know, Valencia, Spain for ICDE or one of these awesome conferences. And again, I mean, I was in my early 30s and just like, but because there was such interest and support by the Qatari government and all the stakeholders involved in this really unique international experiment that I think has been largely successful. I mean, I'm not really in touch with that many people who are still back over there, but even to the transition to the University of Doha, what's the institution currently called, Rob? What's
University of Doha for Science and Technology, I believe.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely.
I always thought they should have called it the Doha University for Science and Technology, DUST, but
in keeping with having a cool acronym and being regionally local. So, again, in terms of what you're occupying your time now with your research endeavors, I mean, you landed almost in the perfect storm, as it were, beginning your current role, as you say, within the context of the emergency remote teaching kind of situation. It seems like now we've almost gone from post-pandemic to post-post-pandemic in a way, which is kind of, you know, there's some cognitive dissonance there for me. But I wonder what kind of projects and initiatives have you most been interested in and passionate about? Because I've seen some of the awesome press books stuff you've been doing with your students. You've been hyping it a lot on LinkedIn, and rightfully so, because some of it's really, really, you know, having your students involved in creation of these artifacts is, to me, a high, you know, achieving goal relative to our, you know, endeavor. So I'd be interested if you wanted to speak to some of that, Rob.
Absolutely. Well, I'll start with the beginning with my full-time tenure here at CBU. You know, I did get thrust into the pandemic like everybody else. And I don't say it was 24 hours after we were sent home that the president of the university called me up, called me back to the university to sit down with him one-on-one, where he told me, you know, we have maybe a half dozen of people on campus who are really experienced with online teaching, and you're the only one trained in it. What do we do? No pressure for somebody in the first year of their tenure. That was an extremely busy 18 months for me while we were teaching online. I ended up starting within our own department, the education department, mostly because the other schools, they were winding down the winter term and weren't going to be picking up again until the fall. Whereas our incoming cohort of BED students, they start in May. So we really had to ramp things up quickly. So myself and the interim dean at the time, then we organized sort of a professional learning group amongst our full-time faculty and our sessional instructors. And we went hard at it, you know, meeting once or twice a week throughout the month leading up to that May term and throughout the entire term. And I spent the first month or so showing them how to set up courses in Moodle, how to make sure that they were effectively designed. And then we transitioned into how to use Microsoft Teams to run online live classes. And once everybody was comfortable with that, we started just doing weekly or bi-weekly debriefing sessions and discussing what was working, what wasn't. And then I would help them troubleshoot and figure out, okay, this is how we could tackle that using Teams. Because at the time, Teams wasn't really designed for education. It was designed for the workplace. So we were sort of inventing it as we went along.
Right.
And then a lot of what we had worked on at that time got chopped up and edited and repurposed for the university at large. And I ended up working with the Faculty Development Working Group to help them sort of redesign the university teaching program. And for the first time ever, we had universal enrollment in the universal teaching program. Every single faculty member registered into it. Now, whether or not they attended all the live sessions or not, they registered in and they took advantage of the resources. I mean, that's unheard of to have at any institution to have universal enrollment in a professional development program. So we ended up having a really, I would say, probably a smoother transition to online teaching than a lot of other institutions, just because of how tightly we all work together to make sure that we leverage technologies properly and that we're sharing pedagogical best practices. And I was also working with the university at the time on something called Start Smart, which was a mini online course we developed for all of our students to take before they came back in September and started the fall term. So we get them set up for what to expect, how to use all the resources, how to be a student in an online environment. And that led into some research opportunities for me. I have a colleague at Ontario Tech University who is currently the interim dean there. And we decided to collaborate on some research to look at, okay, so how did this transition to online teaching go for our faculty? You know, what sorts of resources did they avail of? What did they find the most useful? What would they like to have had more of? And piggybacking on that then, how did it actually change their teaching practices, both while they were online, and how did it change their teaching when they came back to the classroom? So we ended up publishing two papers out of that, one on the supports and one on the pedagogical practices.
And I read the pedagogical practices one, actually. And your colleague from Ontario Tech, it's Robin...
Robin Kay, yeah.
Robin Kay, right, because I was at Ontario Tech for about 3 years. And, I mean, he's such a presence himself in online and distance learning, you know, Ontario Tech, you could say, is actually doing a pretty low key job, actually, relative to their scholarly output and practice. you know, compared to like what Division One or, you know, higher, more perhaps resourced or more profiled universities. I was definitely significantly impressed with the compliment there. And again, I really found with that paper that you and Robin prepared about the, you know, teaching practices, it was informative, it was descriptive, and it was, you know, just kind of a good, you know, checkpoint, if you will, like instead of having to do like a whole meta analysis of all these various publications, it was like, okay, here's a starting point I can use when I'm sort of visioning forward and trying to, you know, avoid any missteps or better still, maximize design opportunities and efficiencies based on what's inside, you know, the fine things.
And what I like about both of those papers is that they're contextualized at a couple of, you know, small to medium sized actual Canadian universities. You really get a feel for what happened there as opposed to a more, like you said, broader theoretical paper or a research meta-analysis of the broader literature. So it really brought it home. This is what we actually went through together, and here's how it's changed things for us. So that was my start to my time here at Cape Breton University. You mentioned my work with the Open Educational Resources and doing stuff with press books.
Please do that at length, bro. It looks super fascinating.
I did some dabbling with it prior to the pandemic, but the opportunity arose. I was teaching a graduate course when we all got sent home for the pandemic. They had about maybe 3 weeks or so left in the course, and they had a major assignment left, which was one of those meta-analyses, mini lit review type papers.
Yeah.
And I sent an email to all of them and I said, hey, I know that you're all struggling now too because you're all teachers and you've been sent home and you have to figure out how to teach your classes online. And now you've got this paper for me too because the term hasn't been called off. So why don't we shift gears here? Why don't you pick something that you're struggling with or something that you've already found a solution to and write about it to share with your fellow teachers. And
awesome.
we put it together in Pressbooks as an open access book, integration of instructional design and technology for a rapid transition to online teaching. And that got some good press around here. You know, CBC ended up calling me up and asking me about it, and I did an interview with a radio station in Ontario about it. And that got some good traction. I've done two more volumes of that with subsequent students since.
Yeah.
I've done a bunch of publications with in press books with students from Ontario Tech University as well. And I've sort of taken a little bit more of a different direction with that this year. You know, last year, I put together my own independent ebook in press books called Everyday Instructional Design. I basically took a bunch of my resources that I was putting up on my website and on YouTube and that I was preparing for my students, and I combined them all into a single open access ebook.
Whoa.
It's out there. It's free of charge for anybody who wants to use it. And by the way, I'm keeping tabs on the analytics on that. I don't have any paid advertising campaign. I'm not getting any money from it, but it's currently got over 13,000 unique readers. Almost 32,000 chapters read in just 18 months. And taking a deep dive into the analytics, I can tell from where the traffic is coming from, it's being used in courses at least 19 different universities around the world. So it's definitely worthwhile putting that out there. I decided
you want to capture that for your tenure application, bro.
Absolutely. Shows the impact factor.
Yeah, but seriously.
But I did another one this year because I was developing a new course for here at Cape Breton University and also one for Ontario Tech on accessible teaching with technology, meeting
awesome.
Accessibility needs.
Very awesome.
So rather than building a brand new course and putting everything inside, locked down inside of Moodle or in Canvas or D2L or whatever, I put it together in Pressbooks.
Yes.
And I decided, you know, Well, I've got to get my students doing some kind of project in this. I opted to go for a similar approach to what I've done in the past, but to do something that was combined. So I put my core readings for my students into this book called The Alt Text, Accessible Learning for Technology. A bit of a play on words there. Alt text being the alternative text you add to images online for accessibility purposes.
Right.
So my core readings are in there. And there's a blank section at the end now because in just a few weeks' time, by early to mid-August of this summer, there's going to be 30 more chapters contributed by my students in that course. They're doing
30.
critic
That's
30,
a
yeah.
lot. That's a lot. Yeah,
Yeah,
that's
I think it's actually 27 students are in the course right now, so it'll be 27 chapters.
a lot.
Each one is doing a critical analysis of an accessibility barrier that students face in their own context and potential solutions for that.
Awesome, bro.
And
Sick.
so that's sort of me combining my instructional resources for them and sharing it with the rest of the world, and them sharing what they're working on in the course with an authentic audience with the rest of the world. But I'm taking it even one step further because I plan on continuing to use this ebook as we go forth. So I'm using a living textbook approach. So let's say that in winter 2025, I offer the course again. There'll be another 25 or 30 chapters added to it. And it'll be under a section, critical analyses of accessibility issues, winter 2025. So it'll be a growing, continuing to grow resource. And I call it open educational resources as pedagogy. So
That
not just
is
using
sick.
open
I love it,
educational
bro.
resources for my students, but actually getting them to produce open educational resources. And what I love about it is rather than them just writing a paper that only I will read, I started shifting at first a few years back to having them do in-class presentations, to having them do their own websites and videos, sharing with gradually with more and more authentic, wider audiences, to now, co-contributing with me to share with the widest possible audience. I find that they take a lot more ownership of their scholarship. They take a lot more ownership
Yes.
of their learning because
Sure.
they can pick whatever topic they want that's meaningful to them. They take pride in it. The quality of the writing that I've seen has skyrocketed when they know that the stakes are the whole world is going to read this. And when they know that, hey, I got to get a published chapter that I can put on my CV and to brag about later on. So, personally, I'm set up with through my Power Learning Solutions website. I use that as a tool, as a platform. Everything on there is under Creative Commons license, basically to promote sharing educational resources and to promote the work of my students and things like that. I'm set up with Libraries and Archives Canada. I can issue ISBN numbers and stuff. I've helped some colleagues publish some research books, and these students, the e-books that they put out, they all get ISBN numbers. They're deposited with Libraries and Archives Canada with legal deposit and all that. So you can go on to the National Library at Ottawa and you can search for these books. And I think one of the most exciting things that I ever heard was when one of my students sent me a quick email saying, I have a friend who's doing the Masters of Education at Western. And she just told me that her teacher assigned my chapter as a required course reading. Like, way to go.
Brilliant.
That's awesome.
That is off the hook. Rob, everything you described, I mean, just sounds so, it comes from a single sort of vision of breaking down a barrier because, I mean, as we both fully are aware, and lots of people watching the show are aware, I mean, the post-secondary learning environment was, built largely in silos. So what you're talking about, having these students take ownership, taking agency, putting out creative outputs vis-a-vis the educational technology production, and then actually going so far. This is where it sort of goes from being, I mean, I was sort of thinking in the back of my mind, like e-portfolios, awesome. But when you're actually taking the scholarly and professional endeavor to the point where you're issuing ISBN numbers, where it's searchable in archives, Canada, to me, that's kind of the that that's kind of an elevated level of practice there, bro. and I have to give you credit for your like planning that, right? The design thinking that informs that pedagogical approach. OER is pedagogy. I am just absolutely stoked.
We follow the whole traditional publishing process for it too. It's like they're not just writing the chapters and we pop them in.
And then putting on like Creative Commons licensing, right?
Yeah.
Because that's
we do that with it too. And we go through the whole we also go through the whole double blind peer review process in the course, and that's actually a course assignment. So I randomly assign them anonymous classmates chapters to do structured peer reviews on, and they get graded on doing the peer reviews. I give them a structure to follow. This time around, we actually spent an entire 3-hour class co-designing the rubric we were going to use to provide feedback to our classmates. So they got to determine what kind of feedback do I want to get to polish this up before I publish it. And now they're in the middle of using that. They came up with 6 different checklists. So students have their choice of which one they want to use. And they're in the process of doing that. They don't know if Matt is reviewing their paper, their classmate Matt, or if I'm the one who's doing it, because I'm in there as a dummy student in the course, a test student in the course. So I can also do a peer review, which I find really helps, because when they submit their final draft to me to put in Pressbooks, they also have to submit a quick summary of what kind of feedback did I get from the instructor and from my classmates, and how did I use that feedback to revise my paper. So they're getting eyes on other people's work, so they can see some of the writing issues that sometimes you don't see with your own work. You don't see the forest through the trees. You're too familiar with it. And then they're getting all this feedback, and they have to get metacognitive with it and explain how the feedback actually used. Yeah. So they're going through that whole process. They're getting a tangible artifact out of it when they complete the course. And they're set up for further academic careers if they want, for actual research and publication when they go further with their graduate studies themselves, because they're used to the peer review process. They're used to the submission and revision process and to actually putting something into a template format so that it can be published. And now they've actually got something published on their CV too that they can brag about when they apply to do their doctorates or for further jobs or.
Rob, there's so much there that I could easily just hone in on any aspect of what you described, whether the pedagogy, the curricular aspects, the assessment and evaluation, the peer evaluation, the self-reflective points for checking in, the professional relevancy, the teaching of digital literacy skills, and additionally, so-called knowledge and wayfinding kind of skills, all of these things within a professional process designed to, as much as possible, simulate, model, and provide the opportunity to sort of step into that other areas of their professional and academic endeavor, scaffolded, as it were, based on physical, tangible evidence of things that they've created through your assignment design here. I would love to spend way more time. I mean, all just reminiscing about CNAQ, folks. I mean, that could even be its own thing. I have been so thrilled and stoked, Rob, to just check in with you, hearing about all the awesome research that you and your colleagues are doing, hearing about all the awesome research that you and your students are doing, as well as these highly innovative principles and practices. Folks, all of these resources that Rob has talked about, or a great number of them, are going to be available on the WordPress post that goes along with this recording. So you'll definitely want to check those out. And again, Power Solutions is
Power,
your consultancy.
It's Power Learning Solutions.
Power Learning Solutions. So we're going to have a link there for sure. And again, just a ton of academic and professional resources above and beyond the significant amount that are even being generated strictly for his work with CBU and past, in affiliations and ongoing. Rob, was there anything else you wanted to just kind of shout out here before we wind her down?
I'll probably throw in one more thing to spark people's imaginations.
Please do.
You know, the living textbook concept that I'm working on with my students right now, it's in a course on accessible learning with technology. And you can probably imagine the writing process itself and the standard chapter or the standard research paper format that you would expect to see in a chapter in a book is not accessible to all learners, depending on their particular needs. So I've thrown one other caveat at them, and that is that in the spirit of UDL, Universal Design for Learning, and being as accessible as possible, they're free to come to me if writing a traditional chapter doesn't work for them, and to propose something else that they could contribute to the ebook. As long as we sit down and have a chat and they show me that it's going to cover the same outcomes that I'm assessing for the course, and that it displays the same level of rigor that their classmates are displaying with their projects. And I've got a couple of really good ones that are in the pipes. There's lots that have a lot of intertwined multimedia embedded in there. I've got one student who's actually proposed to put together a short course in H5P that we can embed in the book about working with autistic students and meeting their challenges, so that you could open up this chapter. Here's a course you could complete in 15 minutes that's going to give you some tips and tricks. So, don't be afraid to shake things up with your students and to let them know that they can do something alternative. And I don't require my students to provide me with documentation from the Accessibility Center or anything like that. It's like, no, you talk to me, you show me how you want to demonstrate the same mastery of the concepts we're doing in the course. And if it meets those criteria, the rigor and the outcomes, then have at it.
Rob, I am legitimately inspired by everything you just described, your whole approach, and as well, just the fact that I know you to be a really thoughtful and passionate dude about this stuff, man. Honestly, I think everybody that is coming in contact with your approach vis-a-vis your students and the people that, you know, your students are going to interact with are all really benefiting from this, again, thoughtful, evidence-informed, experiential, you know, approach to building knowledge with your students and sharing that out in significant public meaningful ways. It has been an absolute slice. As I say, I could spend another 45 minutes of your time here, but I will be respectful of the rest of your schedule, sir. Thank you so much for joining us. I'll end the recording now, unless there's anything else you wanted to go out with here, bro.
No, I just want to say thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I've enjoyed it a lot. Take care, everybody. Bye for now.